I'm John.
And I'm Ron.
And I'm Jason. And this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, we're back for episode 107. I keep doing that. We're back for episode 107 of Digital Divination.
You're fine. You're fine.
93 episodes till we get to 200.
That we're going to start counting down already?
Yes. That's a long time to count.
Yeah,
that's well, aspirational right there.
Started counting at 101, so, you know.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
How are you gentlemen doing today?
I'm doing very well. I have missed a couple games, a couple of games that I've done just because I've had a real busy week at work. Because I work for Wizards of the Coast, and my opinions I express are mine and not theirs. Sometimes those Dungeons and Dragons don't build themselves. People got to build them. Sometimes it makes for some long nights.
That segue was as smooth as butter.
Thank you. How about you, John?
Speaking of butter and smooth, not being smooth, actually. So tomorrow, Monday, our first episode of Scum and Villainy gets posted.
All right.
And
that's tomorrow, Monday. But it's in the past for listeners who are.
Yes. So it'll already be out. For the folks that hear this on Thursday,
you can go listen to it.
Yeah. So any spoilers that come out now will only spoil it for Ron.
Because I wasn't there. I was working.
Because he was in there.
This is not the Session Zero. This is the first episode that we recorded last week.
Just the first episode.
Week.
So all right, I decided not to do the Session Zero because of some of the audio issues that we were having with Mark.
Yeah. And we didn't have one of the people at that time. I mean, not me.
Yeah.
Right. But anyway, because that's going up and I got new music for it, I had to go find the music for it. I had to listen to a lot of music. I had to edit the music so it would be short enough. I had to do our intro in there. I had to come up with a new cut. I spent like 4.5 hours doing this one episode today.
But it's only one time. Can I ask about that? Do you go buy music? Do you commission music? How does that process work for somebody who might want to throw some music on whatever they're doing for an actual play or whatever?
So I bought a license for royalty-free music. I bought a license that allows it to be used on YouTube, social media, things like that, podcasts, whatnot. It's $34, so it wasn't terribly expensive. I've gotten other stuff for a little bit more, a little bit less. But I was trying to find something that would fit the theme that we had. And it's kind of tough, quite frankly. I listened to like hundreds of tracks and going back and forth. And that was probably like an hour and a half of my time trying to just figure out what. And so finally I said, okay, this is the one I think is okay. So Jason, you'll have to listen to it tomorrow.
Yes, I will.
3 days earlier from when this gets posted. And it's just a little bit in the beginning. Basically, we have our intro that's kind of over it, so you can hear it. And then it's at the very end. So it's kind of typically what I do for our actual plays for some music there. But putting that all together and doing the intro and everything, I was telling my wife, it always takes a long time the first time to get it set. And then, I can copy and paste it into the future episodes and things. But that's why I was late for our thing here today, because I spent all that time this morning because I didn't want to forget it and do it after our podcast, which I've done in the past. Right. Then I forgot about our podcast. So
go ahead,
Ron.
I'm going to wait.
No. I was just going to say, I was just going to say like that you spent so much time thinking about podcasts that you forgot we had a recording. You just sort of like,
yes,
assumed you already had done something. Yeah.
Because Sundays I do both. I edit to put up the one for Monday, and we record to do the one for Thursday, which I edit on Wednesday. So I'm just in time editing, you know.
Well, I was just going to say, this is very John Godek, right? Because a lot of the things you do are all about spend a lot of time at the front end to make sure you spend a minimal amount of time throughout the whole process of something, right? You know, you devote a lot of time to building up a class syllabus and what you're going to do. And then you can just teach that sort of thereafter with only minimal modifications, sound at the beginning of the podcast, stuff to do, interviews. That's like really good life advice, listeners. That you
get started early, but then I procrastinate. So this is where you're wrong, Ron. I do a lot up front, so then I can procrastinate a lot at the last second and not get caught off guard. That's really what.
I guess that's fair. That's another way to look at it.
So. Anyway, Jason, how about you? How are things going?
I'm good. I just finished watching the Fallout series this morning.
Yes.
So I'm very up, excited about that. Well, I haven't watched that and like a little bit thinking like, should I run a Fallout game now? I kind of want to run a Fallout game now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, maybe that gets incorporated in if the players, you know, want to do that sort of thing, right?
I guess every game's a Fallout game if the GM wants it to be, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess true. But that's a segue that I think that John was trying to prompt me to talk a little bit about.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've listened to a little bit of Intrepid Scoundrels now, I assume our listeners have, can see that there's a little bit more in this kind of a game. A little bit more sort of player driven narrative stuff, right? You can say, mm-hmm. Why would left, I'm here and I'm going to use this skill to do this sort of thing. And I just kind of wanted to, like, without getting into too many specifics about what happened in the episode, because Ron doesn't know, we could sort of talk a little bit about, like, how you get comfortable with doing that as a player if you're not used to doing that already, if you're, you know, used to playing. And whether you can kind of take it a little bit into, you know, maybe Pathfinder, maybe D&D, maybe Starfinder, that kind of stuff. So, like, I don't have, like an agenda or a syllabus or anything like that, like a John would have. But, you know, just wanted to sort of give this talk a little bit about it. Like, if you get to a point where, you know, you – because a lot of games like this, you have, like, you generally have a good skill on something, right? Something you're good at, right? And it's the game, right. Same with the D&D, same with Pathfinder, Starfinder, right? You have something you might be pretty good at, fighting or shooting, or like you've got the best life science skill. And you want to use it as much as possible because it's your best thing and you put points into it. You spent, you know, you put character, not wealth exactly, but character
resources.
Points or whatever, you know, resources, yeah. Thank you, that's the word. Put resources into it. But you can't use it for everything in a game like, you know, D&D or Pathfinder, Starfinder, but you can kind of, like in a Blades in the Dark style game, kind of try to finagle your way into situations where that becomes the way to do the thing you want to do. So let's say that you want to get information out of somebody or out of a place, and you're like, oh, we don't have information. Let's go get information. Sure, there are information gathering style skills, right? You know, you get your diplomacy type stuff, but in stuff like Blades, and you've got like sway and consort, you know, just for more of like chatting with people kind of skills. But maybe you don't have those kind of social skills, but maybe you're a really good mechanic on something. You have, you know, engineering, or you've got this the rig skill in Scum and Villainy. How do you go about using that? Well, you can, especially in Scum and Villainy, be like, well, what I can do is maybe I'll go find a garage and start chatting with people. I know a lot about mechanical stuff, so if I start chatting with other mechanics, maybe I can get a little bit of like gossip out of them. And that might be like, well, while you're doing that, you're trying to fix the same, you know, you're trying to help them fix a thing, and that's how you get them on your side. And so you make the role of that check. So, I mean, it's just a matter of just trying to, I don't have like advice exactly, because I don't know the formula for figuring out how to do that. But it just comes around thinking a little bit more broadly about what your skills mean. Does that make sense?
It does. One of the things I found that runs up against, I guess the constraints around that tend to be not just game master skepticism, but player skepticism, right? Because mm-hmm. you can be,
right.
I think all of us had the experience where we're around a table where somebody's, oh, I really want to use my acrobatic skill again. I'm like, really? In negotiating with the prince? And the rest of the players are like, really? I don't think I can't, you know, I can't see that. And then the player's like, fine, I'll have to use my, you know, persuasion or whatever. But I think that that tends to be sort of a social limiter on the everything that you do, try to do as many things as you can with the things that you're really good at game. But I've certainly been there. The character that I have made but not yet played, even by this time of the listeners in Scum and Villainy, because I didn't make it, is kind of this, you know, small town mayor who's run out of stuff. It's based on a character that I played in a Firefly game, which uses the Cortex system, where you've got dice assigned to your ability scores, basically, and then dice assigned to your skills, and you just mix and match them for whatever you're doing. Oh, and my character's highest ability score was strength, and my highest, because I was a small town mayor, my highest skill was bureaucracy. And man, I was looking for any number of ways I could do strength plus bureaucracy for anything.
Wow. That's good.
Like, I'm really going to do this paperwork.
That's fair enough. I mean, Ron, you make a good point about the narrative sort of like not wearing the same tread to the point where you fray the carpet out, right? To like, oh, I'm doing this the same way again. You know, the narrative always gives us the framework. We know whether or not that's actually going to work. If you've got a kind of an open world type situation, right? You just can be like, what do you want to do? Maybe you can do the, you know, do the thing where you talk to the mechanics and get the thing. But like, if you're in the middle of a fight or something like that, you might not be able to necessarily say, oh, I'm going to use my rig skill here to mechanic my way into punching a guy, right? Like, no, yeah, maybe that one's borderline. And then, you know, but if you're constantly doing it, it does become rote and tired to the point where it doesn't feel like it's fun anymore, and even to the player. Mm-hmm. And a game like Scum and Villainy has that sort of social contract. I'd like to use this, and the GM can be like, well, no, maybe this seems like more like a sway, you know, a consort to me. Okay, fair enough. I'll roll that because you know I think the roles are kind of maybe like fewer and far between than in say a D&D or a Pathfinder, where you have a lot more like, I'm going to roll a bunch when it comes to combat. I'm going to have to roll several times during this skill check to skill challenge to, you know, research in this library or whatever, right? So it kind of averages out that maybe you're not using the best skill you're using all the time, but you're using enough of your skills it kind of evens out. But if you're rolling fewer times, you kind of want to try to play to your strengths, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that.
So, Jason, when you mentioned you wanted to talk about player-driven narrative, I was actually thinking about it a little bit different way.
Oh, yeah.
But it actually, the way I was thinking about it actually dovetails in well with what you're talking about. So, you know, Jason's talking about how you can talk about, the players can discuss, role-play different abilities and skills they have to accomplish things. Overcome challenges, do tests. And one of the things I noticed about Scum and Villainy while we're playing it is that because it's so open as to what we are going to do, right? The world is open. We're presented with a problem. We can approach the problem any way we want.
Yes,
and so what we saw then is that our players would look at, okay, well, here's kind of my backstory. Here's what my character's all about. These are the things I like to do. These are the things I'm good at. How maybe can I take an approach to solving the problem, the more immediate one? So we had to find somebody, we had to get information, you know, the typical things you might do. And a lot of the skills that we were using were not typical of maybe what we've seen in Pathfinder, Starfinder, D&D, because how the players kind of articulated what they wanted to do and how they were going to approach it. There was no... In a, you know, predetermined adventure, you know, a scenario or adventure path or something, it always says, here's the skill things you have to accomplish. Here's the approach you can take. Or sometimes it'll say, and the players can use a suitable profession if they want, or they can get extra bonus points for role playing or doing things like that. This is kind of stark contrast to that, where it's all about the role play and then maybe a couple roles to make that decision point. So it's a little bit, it's less die driven, I think, than the other D20 games that we've been playing.
Well, you know, I'll show you a peek behind the curtain a tiny bit, John, too. That is like, when I'm running games like this, I maybe write down like three sentences, and then just go, what do you guys want to do? Here's the problem, right? Always just show, here's the problem. I know what the problem is going to be ahead of time. I know maybe some character names and some a little bit of personalities there. And then I just kind of like improvise most of it, essentially, right? Because I want you all to sort of feel like you're in the improvising the story along with me.
Right.
And I want to know, like, okay. Let's say not to say this is in the game and all, but let's just say, you know, the goal, you know what the goal is. You've got to steal that thing. And I tell you, there's a thing there that you want to steal. Very valuable thing. It's going to get you a lot of money. If you steal that, you'll get the money. You know that it's locked away in a vault and well guarded and lots of security. What do you want to do? You know, and then it's just like, how you know, when you in a game, when you have more characters that have more social skills, of course you're all going to be like, well, let's try to talk our way into the vault in some fashion, or talk our way to the point where we can nab it and run. Great. Hey, we're a bunch of mechanically oriented characters. Great. How can you break the security systems and get into that vault? Or you're just a bunch of toughs. Let's just start punching people. Good. Go. Like, punch our way in, punch our way out. Great. We can do that. And from that is where I can kind of like decide, like, get the tiny little pieces that I have that I've already written down and expand on them a little bit. Oh, we're going to talk a little bit more about punching our way in and punching our way out. Great. Let's dig into what the security systems are and who the security system is. All right. And that's when I can say, you know, pull out from, say, either my imagination or my, you know, knowledge of sort of Star Wars canon and be like, oh, there's something going on here, or something that I found otherwise. Like, there is something I did find in that I thought was pretty fun that was from deep Star Wars lore to pull up. But like, oh yeah, grab that. There's a big bruiser. Oh yeah. Oh, not just one of them. There's two of them. And oh, of course, when you've got maybe like a force sensitive character, these guys have these, I remember one time when I was running the D20 Star Wars system, I thought it'd be fun to like, okay, the bunch of, you know, they were playing more Jedis and stuff like that. And I'd be like, okay, well, you got to fight a Rancor. But this Rancor has been crossbred with that one weird lizard that is immune to force effects, basically, you know, essentially force powers. So like, then they're like, oh no. And just sort of throw that sort of wrench. But like, you know, like, hey, great. But that, you know, D20 game, I had to think about that a little more ahead of time. But stuff like that, and what can you throw into the blender and then play off then? Okay, you're, you know, maybe failing to punch your way in. Well, then you get, instead of just sort of putting up the roadblock there, figure out a way to like, and I'm not talking about this, I'm not talking about player agency anymore, of course. I'm just talking about how I run the games. Right. You know, but, you know, failing forward to a point where you can fail, then succeed your way out. But anyway, so, but that rolling it back a bit, when you're given that sort of open canvas, how do you think about what your character's best at to the situation, I think is always the question you need to ask yourself in a game like this.
Well, it sounds like your minimal prep leads towards zooming way out on a situation, because you can, and you'll often see this in like published adventures, it'd be like, oh, to get into the barracks, you have to overcome this locked door. Who's got the computers or the electronics, you know, in order to get through this specific lock on this specific door so that you guys can get into the barracks and do the next thing. But if you're really zoomed out about it, it can be like, all right, well, there's a soldier at the barracks who has some info. You got to talk to that guy, right? Go. How do you get, maybe it is we sort of hack our way through a door. Maybe it's we sneak our way in as part of a delivery. Maybe we wait for the guy to leave. Maybe we try to find out where he's got family in town or whatever. I mean, if you've got minimal notes, it allows you to zoom way out, and that doesn't stick people to the, oh, it's a door. I need to have one of two skills to get through a door to be, oh, well, there's a lot of different ways we can approach this problem. What's the way my character, it would be best at approaching this problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really strikes me as a lot like a homebrew, where you kind of have your story thought up and you have a rough outline, and then you're kind of moving with it depending on how the players go. And the interesting thing, so at NorwestCon a couple of weeks ago, I ran my Starfinder Bounty 1, the Cantina job, which I've run a whole bunch of times. And I've ran it for three people who weren't really familiar with Starfinder. And because I've run it so much, I basically didn't use the text at all. I just kind of freeform. I kind of know, here's the basic story. I give them the basic story. I know the names of the players in there. And just kind of let, similar to what Jason's doing with this Scum and Villainy, I just kind of let them drive it how they wanted to go. And what was really interesting is they took it in a different direction than all the groups that I've put it through that have been forced kind of down a more rote storyline. You know, yeah. Oh, you can do this, use this skill, do this. Because they basically said, oh, let's try doing this. How would I accomplish that? I said, well, you have these sorts of skills. Maybe you could try that. And so it was really kind of fun, you know, because I know it so well, I could not mm-hmm. have to feel like I'm running it, but more like feel like I'm letting them choose their own adventure going through just with this loose storyline.
Well, and it's at that point that, I mean, the best of the player driven narratives hardly have a true storyline at all. That is to mm-hmm. say, it's got a setting, it's got right. antagonists with goals, but it doesn't have a plot. And a lot of published adventures that you have will have a plot in it that right. you're sort of expected to follow all the way through, but the player driven narratives really kind of don't. And the that campaign I ran last summer, very short form
right.
Right. campaign, I started that out with, okay, the players are in a town, very small mountain town, and I knew who the villains were and sort of what the villains kind of roughly wanted to do. But the way that the players got involved is each character knew somebody who died in this big explosion, right? Mm-hmm. And so from there it was, well, what was it? You know, where did the sudden and unexpected explosion even come from? Who was involved? You know, do we want to investigate? They start hearing things in different parts of the valley, weird things that are going on. Some of them they just never chose to investigate. That's fine. It just kind of didn't matter. That wasn't part of a plot that they investigate that. It was just mm-hmm. part of the setting that they didn't choose to follow up on. They were instead off in another part of the valley following up on another different thing. And that I feel like leads. So having a setting that's fairly well thought out and villain goals that are fairly well thought out, and then stop, right?
Right.
And then put your players into that situation and see how they respond to things is a good way to mm-hmm. to sort of enforce player-driven narrative. It sometimes scares players who are really used to being sort yeah. of handheld by a narrative.
Right.
To being told what they need to do. The plot isn't telling me what I need to do next. What do I even do next? How do you help, Jay? This is something that you seem to have a lot of experience with. How do you do that when people are sort of expecting to be led to the next plot point, but there isn't one? What do you do with them?
Give them a couple minutes to sort of try to get used to it. Maybe encourage a little conversation in between the players. Like, you know, talk about who you are and what you want to do and how you want to do it a little bit. And if they're still kind of quiet at the table, I would just essentially start to do the kick down the door with the guy with the gun.
Raymond Chandler.
Raymond Chandler. Yeah,
it is, yeah. Raymond Chandler. Yep,
Raymond Chandler. It's a thing that's always in the back of my head. You know, just to sort of like, oh, this is what. Okay, we need a little, because if players aren't comfortable, they will need a little bit of, I don't want to say handholding because that sounds condescending, but something to give them something to grab onto. Like, oh, bam, mm-hmm. here comes someone who is like, you, I'm going to kill you now. Oh, I know how to deal with this. One, right. give them something immediate right. to deal with. Once they've dealt with that, that'll kind of like, oh, well, then who sent this guy? They might get in. They'll have a little something to kind of grab onto to give them a breadcrumb of sorts to lead them some mm-hmm. to a little bit more. And then they can kind of like decide and branch off. I've been also generally pretty lucky about groups who, when I present this kind of thing, I'm like, here's five things. What do you guys want to do? Essentially, like, here are five, like, plot hooks, you know, missions essentially that you've been assigned to. And they're like, oh, wait, I want to talk about this. Oh, let's get this one first. This one sounds the most important. I'm like, okay, yeah, that one is now the most important. And, you know, and build on it from there. So it's tough. It can be tough. And sometimes I feel like if players aren't grabbing on, maybe I end up, what do you guys want to do? Do you want to try A or B or C? You know, like giving choices. And people go, mm-hmm. oh, yeah, and then, well, what if we did A, but with a little bit of C involved? Maybe that helps. But then sometimes I feel like I end up leading them too much. So, you know, it's never perfect, but I try.
Well, this is not going to help when you said you didn't want to sound condescending, but let me sound a little bit condescending here. This came up in one of the panels that I was at NorwestCon, which as far as, you know, giving players more agency, but when they get paralyzed by the number of options available, you know, when my kids were really young, right? When you go out to a restaurant, I'm not going to tell them everything that's on the menu. I'm going to look over the menu and go, well, do you want a cheeseburger or do you want chicken nuggets? Right. I'm giving them some choice, but I'm not giving them they can't process the entire menu of choice sort of simultaneously. But then once a couple of times after, well, did you want a cheeseburger, chicken nuggets? They're like, well, actually, there's this other. I see these other things on here. Can I have one? Yes, you can. Right. Your world is broadening now and you have more choice. So
in a way that's sort of like how I would approach people who maybe don't play like games with a lot of like character options during character creation. Like, okay, well, just kind of tell me what it is you kind of want to do, and I can give you some choices about like, I want to be a guy, you know, someone who punches real good. Oh, you can be a monk, or you can be a fighter who does the unarmed stuff. You know, like you can which one of these? And here's the advantage of this, and here's the advantage of that. Disadvantage of both, right? Which way do you want to go with it that way? And that's in a way, hopefully you can sort of extrapolate that into a session when you're like, well, what do you want? You know, how you want to do this? And then like put that, if it's not kicking the door with someone who's immediately trying to kill them, give them something in the same sort of way. Show them there's a ticking clock in some way. Mm-hmm. I try to also think a little bit about, you know, when you're talking about actual play episodes, what comes at the, you know, and end of that hour when you're doing a recording, but also try to, you know, look at the session and think a little bit about like, oh, if this were a TV show, when would the commercial break come? And what do you do right before the commercial break? You kind of give a little hook. It makes people want to stay through the commercials, right? So you'd be like, oh, when you see this thing that's happening that is going to be, if you don't take care of it, if you don't deal with it in some way, it's going to be bad for the plot of the story in some fashion. A while back, I'm going to tell you all about the games that I used to design in a week with a couple of friends of mine. We did like two or three of them. And one of them was a game that we ended up calling it Monkey Dome, because it was we were thinking a little bit about the scene from, you know, we were talking a little bit about Mad Max earlier, Ron.
Right.
That one scene from Beyond Thunderdome where there's this fight with the one guy in the Thunderdome, and then they take a helmet off and like, oh no, he's just a, you know, he's like a child. So it was like, well, that was like a weird genre shift, a little tone shift in the whole movie. Cause it was all gritty, you know, punching before that. So we sort of like had this idea. And then for some reason we got stuck on the movie Monkey Bone, an old,
like the animated,
it's sort of partially animated, Brendan Fraser movie.
Okay.
Anyway, so then we took Thunderdome and Monkey Bone and we smashed together. But anyway, it was a post-apocalyptic game where you essentially don't roll to succeed at anything. You roll to see how the tone of what your action is, essentially, right? So it's like, I'm gonna fight this person. I'm gonna roll these two dice. Whichever comes up higher is the tone. It's like, is it gonna be gritty or is it gonna be silly? Right. Okay. Basically. But we'd always, when we wrote this, we talked a little bit about. By the way, this game is free if you can find it somewhere. talked a little bit about presenting the thunder and the storm. I believe that's how we called it. And the thunder was like basically like, and the rumbling in the distance of like something that's going to happen if you don't. But the storm is the immediate threat, but then or the immediate situation. And the thunder is like, oh, well, you can, you know, okay, right now you're in this post-apocalyptic wasteland, and you know, it's for right now, you know, you're in some building that's crumbling. And you need to save yourself. But you also see off in the distance this cloud of dust rising from a bunch of approaching vehicles. You don't know what that is yet, right? But you know that it's coming, and you can kind of think about how that might affect what you want to do in the actual action of the thing. I forget what I was going with that. Essentially just sort of like presenting something that is a little, you know, a little much like, okay, this is not an immediate threat, but it will eventually become one. Is one way to get people a little bit motivated.
Foreshadowing. Yeah. So, you know, I was watching a movie with my wife, and I was commenting on how the writers had done a good job making callbacks to things that seemed random in the beginning and all of a sudden became meaningful later. Right. But the thing is, it wasn't really tightly, it wasn't a good foreshadow. It was just a random thing. Right. So you're talking about foreshadowing something and then maybe it's small, right? Maybe it's big, but later on it becomes very apparent how critical that was, how it ties in. And then the decisions that the team has made, you know, once they got that information, kind of influence how that whole scene would kind of unfold then.
And here's the thing. It doesn't have to be anything. Like, what? If you foreshadow something, it doesn't have to come back if no one cares. You know, if you give a little something and it's just sort of like no one picks up on it, no one remembers it, it's gone. Forget about it. Don't worry about it too much.
Until the very end. Then they'll say, oh, yeah, remember that guy that we were supposed to do? Yeah. Oh, shoot, we forgot to get back to that. I wonder what happened. Yeah.
If they remember, you know, yes, bring it back in some way. But, like, you know, there's a lot going on. Players are worried about their characters and their real lives. They're not going to necessarily pick up on everything. So don't necessarily bring something back and go, like, well, you forgot that I'm injured. Because that smacks a little bit of, like, you've had a story that you wanted to tell them, a specific story, and it you know, becomes more, you know, railroady or whatever. But it not to say you can't remind people of, like, oh, this was important, because you do, they did pick up on at the time, right? Oh, this might have been an important thing that you all forgot because it's been 2 weeks since we've played, et cetera, and everyone's had their own problems. But don't hold that something over their head if they didn't pick up on it and don't care. But maybe someone will. Maybe you'll do something you don't think is a foreshadow, and that's another thing that people are like, well, what about this? What about that silver ingot?
Yeah,
we don't have silver now. Like, oh, well, now I have to make that a whole thing. This is getting a lot more into, like, what you do as a GM for this kind of stuff. But, like, I think it's helpful to think about it in a way that you can give the players a little more, like, present them a little more agency, the opportunity to have the agency.
One of the things that's important about this is that it's a group is never monolithic in what they're interested in or what they remember. And there's a social dynamic that you can really use to your advantage. If, for example, you got five players and one of them is like, oh, this seems like an important thing, we should get to that. And the other four are like, yeah, we'll get to it. We're going to do this other thing. And, you know, the player's like, well, this other thing was important to me, so let's maybe get around to that afterward. That's so valuable to me as a GM, because I'm like, okay, now I can make that kind of a thing, right? Mm-hmm, now they've given me some forewarning without even meaning to. They've given me some forewarning about how they are going to let this other player have their turn, but it may not be this session. It might not be for another couple of sessions, but I've got a little bit of time to make that player that kind of, you know, use that hook, right? It's like, this is a thing that I want to follow up on to make it cool that they did, right? To make that narrative, to that really feel like they've driven the narrative or they've steered the narrative in a way that is, like, really rewarding to them. Now, rewarding to them could be, like, terrible, right? It could be that they had, like, they all think, oh, if we'd have done what you wanted first, we would have averted some awful situation that's gotten way worse because we waited three or four sessions before we got to it. But even that makes them feel like their decisions really matter. So
yeah, it's always important. You have, like, these, you know, D&D, Pathfinder, Starfinder, you have these micro decisions that always make things important. Like, where am I on the battlefield to do this? Where, you know, when, what skill do I use during the skill challenge to do this? But in other games, like, you know, the Blightstep games, you have the more broader kind of, like, macro decisions about, because, you know, like I said, you might not be rolling as often. So you want to make every roll kind of count. And so that makes them more sort of makes these decisions a little broader, makes them sort of help you steer where the game goes.
So, you know, given this player driven narrative type of game, I like it. I think it's kind of fun as a player. And I think it'd be a lot of fun as a GM to kind of orchestrate this thing. Now, as a game designer, which both of you are, doesn't that kind of shift up what you do? In fact, maybe put you out of business a little bit in terms of the adventure writing and put you more into, you know, into the rules and lore side of things. And if the player is going to be driving that narrative.
I mean, maybe that's, I mean, what is the thing that is most important to me about working in this industry? I like helping people tell fun stories with their friends. That is my highest goal. Sometimes I meet that goal by making sure there are rules that are fun. And so it's very crunchy and mechanical. And sometimes it is, I meet that goal by trying to craft interesting villains that, you know, are real memorable, that these, you know, people who are experiencing this story can really sort of relate to and really like. And even though, I mean, when you're freelancing and you're paid by the word, sure, something that's going to drill down to the specifics of every room in the barracks and the DC to pick the lock on the door is going to be a whole lot more words that are paid at a per word rate than just the three sentences that Jason was just talking about getting going. I do think that as we've already started leaning in this very discussion, there's a lot to be said about GM advice too. There's different ways of having people helping people tell the stories. You either get into some of the very specifics in order to lead them with a plot that has these specific points that occur, or maybe branching plots or something like that. But there's a kind of a lot to be said as well about how, look, if you have no plot and are going to be playing based on the decisions of your characters, the way that your players drive the narrative, I can write just as many words giving you tools to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah. And if you get into like the sort of nitty gritty of things, I feel like the books that don't have adventures in them, or, you know, the books that are not, they're not adventures, I should say, do tend to sell more books, mainly because they are for players and GMs, whereas adventures are almost exclusively for GMs. Mm-hmm. So, and a sort of business side of things, you cut away a little bit of the business, sure, if you say never making it, you write a system, a whole new system that never has adventures in it, whatever. That's one way to work in and just sort of give out, these are more player options, or this is GM advice. These are sort of broad strokes of a setting with, always like to put little plot seeds in there, right? Like, this might happen. And, as a GM, when you're reading that, you get an idea for an entire campaign just by reading like two sentences. Or as a player, you might get an idea for a backstory reading those two sentences. Oh, I came from this thing that happened. I think that's fine. I think, just sort of building on what Ron said, we can always write more of the stuff that the people want, right? If you're in a position to have a game that is maybe not as, and it comes down to like games that like Blades in the Dark and like Scum and Villainy have, they're not as, the people making them aren't Wizards and Paizo, right? They're Evil Hat's pretty big, but that's just more like, they're more like a publisher. They don't have necessarily all these people on retainer to write these things, right? People sell them their manuscripts and then write them. And John Harper of Blades in the Dark, he's writing different games all the time. And that gets you your audience, right? That's a different audience of people than the people necessarily. Obviously, there's some overlap, but the people who are into the, more focused, not focused, but just sort of like, hey, here's the story that, that you can tell with your friends, or, here's the D&D stuff. Gosh, I forgot. I do this all the time. I start a sentence and I forget how I'm going to end it. People will play this game and in a way they're sort of like, yeah, they're built for longer campaigns, and you kind of, some of them are for shorter campaigns than for others, where, a game with 20 levels in it is built to be like, you play it over the 20 levels. That takes a long time. Mm-hmm. A game necessarily like a smaller game. I mean, Blades in the Dark has I think a lot of campaign potential as well, but like there's other smaller games whose names are suddenly escaping me. You only maybe play them five times and then you play a different game. And that's fine, because they're built to do that, in a way that's sort of fast and furious. You get in there, you tell the story of a living dungeon or whatever, and then you get out. I just was thinking about a game called Heart that I just was watching a YouTube review of, which is about a living dungeon and all those sort of things like that. But so it's okay. in terms of the business model, obviously you look at the sales data, obviously Wizards and Paizo are up at the top there, and Evil Hat or whatever might not be making a blip, but like they're selling books that people do want because people get excited about games like Blades in the Dark and Scum and Villainy and do actual plays involving them.
Yeah, neither of these are wrong. And there's a lot more crossover, I think, than you might think. There are a lot of people who really like digging into some of the invent mechanical crunchiness in games that don't have it. You know, there are a lot of people who want to sort of port over, you know, mini systems from other, you know, crunchier games that they have in, you know, something like Fate that's otherwise really light. And then there are people, Savage Worlds, things like that, that tend to be sort of, you know, faster games. But then there are a lot of people who take very crunchy games like, you know, Pathfinder or Dungeons and Dragons that have, you know, sort of a lot of rules to them. And then just for certain sessions or even entire campaigns, just kind of toss a lot of those rules out in order to use some of the basic frameworks that they have. I've been working on that a little bit myself. I'm trying to make one of the Pathfinder games that I run sort of a little bit more player-driven narrative, a little more freeform than it has been. And I've had some success in that regard, you know, here's the path that the plot is going to take you, sort of here's your next goal. How do you want to go about that? You know, that sort of questioning, I think, has been there's not only a lot of crossover among the players, I think there's a lot of crossover in how these games can be run.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, no, I agree. I just thought it was interesting, you know, when Jason said, oh yeah, I just ran this on three sentences. So why do we need whole books for it, you know?
I also like running games where I know every, you know, like have the campaign written out for me, because I'm like, I don't have time to always write the campaign. I have time to write three sentences and riff on it if I feel like that's a place where I can do that. But a game like Pathfinder, when I'm also playing it on, you know, Foundry with the maps, you know, I need that time to put those together. And if someone is doing that for me, I love it. I love it all for it. And then I can, from there, like mold things in a way that, like, I have not completely changed the ending of the Outlaws of Alkenstar, but like the last book has kind of gone a little individual. Like, I've just taken the pieces and kind of moved them around a little bit and using the pieces that I have and just sort of telling not a different story per se, but just a sort of a one that's not written exactly in the book.
And I think players appreciate that. There's so many times when, you know, players want to try something and they feel they're being railroaded into a direction, decision, next step, whatever it is. And as a GM, if you can not railroad them, if you can give them a lot of flexibility and do things, in Adventure Path, you can do that. With Society Play, one of the big issues is you're supposed to run rules as written, everything, you know, in there, you know, there's certain optional things, otherwise you're going to go through it. And that's usually where you get the case where the GM is going to be a little stricter, but still, if you kind of know what the players want to do, you can massage it a little bit and say, okay, well, yeah, so that this thing will work out as well.
When I've got a friend of mine who was very subversive in that regard, very many, many years ago when I was running an organized play group at the university I was at, I had a guy who's since become a very good friend of mine. He showed up knowing that he hated the strictures of like a 4-hour organized play. He just didn't like it. That's not how he liked to play. It's not how he liked to run stuff. But he kind of sort of swallowed his dislike, kept it hidden, mostly. It's not entirely. But he kept it hidden just to show up for a couple of weeks until he found like the other players for whom he knew were also maybe a little rankled by the strict rigidity of that sort of structure, one of which was me. And then he took that group and formed his own group. And we ended up running for years and years and years with a lot of exceptionally sort of freeform things. So he was, I still talk today about how he was sort of a spy for freeform gaming in my organized play structure that I had set up.
Well, and oftentimes, like, you know, I started with a group with organized play, and that group has completely moved away from organized play and just kind of, you know, doing their own thing now. It's just kind of how it happens. All right, well, this has been an interesting kind of a nice overview and some deep dives into player-driven narratives for Starfinder, Pathfinder, D&D, but also Scum and Villainy, which anybody who's listening to this should go back and take a look at Monday's recording and see how it actually takes place in that one.
I will. I can't yet. It is the future for me. It's the future for our listeners. So it's the future for me.
So we can't even talk about it now. Our listeners won't get any spoilers, but you would.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm John.
And I'm Ron.
And I'm Jason. And this has been Digital Divination.